Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Now that's the fun part of our program. We get to talk about what Yahweh shared with us, and very few things that he shared with us are as important as the Ten Statement he etched in stone. And from my perspective, what he said at the conclusion of the second of three statements that appears on the first of two tablets may be as important as anything ever written. We were considering these words yesterday. We're going to delve more deeply into them today. But this is from Shemoth. Shemoth is the second book of the Torah. Torah, by the way, means teaching, guidance, direction, and instruction. That is the definition of Torah. It's from Yara, the verb. The verb Yara means source from which teaching and guidance flow. It's the basis, by the way, of the name of the city, Jerusalem. Yara and Shalom have been combined to create Jerusalem, which means it's the source from which teaching and guidance regarding reconciliation flow in the name of that city. But Torah means teaching. Once you embrace that concept, then you have come to a huge step towards understanding Yahweh's nature as our Heavenly Father, about his desire to create a family, because you guide children, you teach children, you do not lay down the law for children. And so the moment the Christian myth that the Torah means law and that you have to obey laws is wiped from the gunk of your brain that religion has placed there, then at least you're in a position to see Yahweh as the Father of the Covenant, providing guidance for his children. The name of the second book of the Torah is Shemoth. It means names. It is the place where Yahweh introduces us to many very important names, one of which is Moshe, which means to withdraw, to draw out. And it speaks of Moshe playing the role as the scribe of the Torah and as Yahweh's associate through the Exodus, of drawing his people away from the political and religious oppression, the military and economic oppression of Egypt. And so that name is paramount to the book named names, and also it's in Shemoth that Yahweh not only introduces his name to Moshe, but defines his name, telling us that his name is based on the Hebrew verb Haya. Haya means exists. In the first person, as Yahweh stated it, it means I was, I am, and I always will be. It, just in the basis of his name, it tells us that the myth of Christendom, where God allegedly dies, is invalid. God cannot die. He always was and always will be. With that introduction, this is from the 20th chapter, the 6th verse. Note also that chapters and verses are a modern contrivance. They were first considered, I think it's somewhere in the 18th century. A fellow was riding on his horse, and I guess was having trouble with the jarring of the horse keeping track of where he was, and said, you know, this would be so much easier if these books were broken down into chapters and verses. It was probably one of the great calamities of human history when that occurred, because people think that it is appropriate now to take a verse out of context and to cite it to prove this, that, or the other thing. And anytime you do that, you're removing the statement from the environment that enables you to understand what is being said. So before we cite this statement from Yahweh, it is important that we know the context that it was presented in. God introduced himself by name. He said, I am Yahweh, your God. He provided his title and his name. And then he told us that he himself was responsible for our salvation, that he led us away from the crucibles of human, religious, and political oppression. And went on to say that his involvement in our lives frees us. It does not enslave us, as Paul writes of his Torah. It is our source of freedom. And he concludes that first statement by saying, you just will not be able to exist in my presence with other gods, which would eliminate Allah and Jesus Christ and Shiva and Mao and Stalin and all of those who presented themselves as divine. This then flows into the second of the three statements, which is an overt condemnation of religion and politics. And it begins by telling us that we should not ascribe and show any devotion to, speak on behalf of, bow down in the presence of, show homage to any political or religious symbol. And God goes on to say that it is through the religion and politics in this environment that fathers corrupt their own children, creating perversions that twist his message, and that has a lingering and negative effect on children. From there, and this is also after God says that he is a jealous God, that Yahweh says, I am zealous and jealous. So he's explaining why he's not going to share us with other religions, why he's not going to allow us to walk into his home with other religions, that he is protective of his children and doesn't want his covenant children to be harmed by the consequence of religion and politics. He then tells us what the alternative is, that rather than corrupting our children with religion and politics and oppressing them and killing them and perverting them, that we ought to understand Yahweh's role in our lives, what his purpose and plan is, what he's offering us. And in that context, he says, so I will genuinely act and actually engage to literally prepare, perform, and produce, asa, unmerited and unfailing mercy, unearned favor and undeserved kindness, chesed, on behalf of thousands who move toward me and who love me, la ahab, and also who approach me by closely observing and carefully considering, la shamar, my terms, my mitzvah, the conditions of my covenant. Now, he etched this in stone. He made it absolutely clear to us that he himself is offering mercy. So the myth that faith in the gospel of grace is somehow a replacement for Yahweh's Torah, for Yahweh's involvement in our lives, is contradicted by this statement from God. Not only is grace the name of the Roman gratia, which were the naked forms of the lascivious gods of goddesses of partying and merriment, but chesed, mercy, is from Yahweh, not from the pen of Paul. This statement, and we talked about this in previous programs, that awon in this statement is the ultimate form of that corruption that God said that fathers perpetrate on their sons to the third and fourth generation. That awon is the worst thing that we can do, while chesed is the best. This is the counterpart. Fathers corrupt their children, Yahweh supplies mercy. And as we consider this, the word that really jumps out at us, and we began to discuss this in our program yesterday, as Aleph, written as Alephim in this context. Alephim means thousands. That's what it means. That's how many people Yahweh says that his mercy will be given to. And he goes and quantifies the two conditions that are prerequisites for receiving his mercy. Walking to him in love and closely examining and carefully considering the terms and conditions of his covenant. Those are the two preconditions to receive his mercy. So there are things that we need to do if we wish to receive his mercy. And what he tells us is that thousands are going to do these things and therefore receive them. God's not suggesting here that only some of those who approach him in love and only some of those who observe the terms and conditions of his covenant are going to receive mercy. What he's telling us is that the number of those who do those two things numbers in the thousands, and God is 100% dependable. So 100% of those who do those two things, who walk to him in love and who observe the terms and conditions of his covenant, will receive mercy. The crying shame is that only thousands avail themselves of this. Only thousands actually do this. Now, of course, this is a complete repudiation of the concept of faith-based salvation. You know, there are two things that one must do. Walk to God in love and observe, therefore consider, come to know and understand the terms and conditions of his covenant, which there are five. Those required doing. And even the walking to God is a doing thing. Because approaching God, there's only one path, and it requires us to answer seven invitations each year. The first of those invitations to meet with God and to be called out of this world is Passover. That's the doorway to life. The second, the following day, is matzah, which is unyeasted bread, which is the means that God uses to perfect us, is the following day. It's another invitation that we need to observe to meet God if we wish to walk to him in love. This leads to Bakorim, which is firstborn child, where we are adopted into God's family, and to the fourth of the fulfilled Moed Mikre, or these meetings to be called out and meet with God, which is Shavua, which is the promise of seven, where we are enriched with God's teaching and empowered by his Spirit. This path leads to Sukkah, which is the seventh step, which is where we enter God's home and live with him forever. So that's the path to walk to God in love. And the terms and conditions of the covenant, which God says are a prerequisite for receiving his mercy, are as follows. And if you want to know them and discover them for yourselves, then read the Bereshith, which is in the beginning account, Genesis, where Yahweh approaches Abraham. And consider what Yahweh asks of Abraham and what Abraham agrees to do, and you will understand the terms and conditions that comprise the covenant. When we return to Shattering Myths, I will articulate each of those five terms and conditions, and then we will examine the word Elephim to understand what it means and how many people actually avail themselves of these opportunities. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. We're considering the statement that Yahweh etched in stone regarding number of people who will avail themselves of the offer that he has given us, the means to walk to him and become perfect, along with the terms and conditions of his covenant. I just explained what the means, the path that Yahweh has provided for us to walk to him and become perfect. So I'd like to share, if I may, the five terms and conditions of the covenant, which are prerequisites for receiving Yahweh's mercy. If you would like to discover these on your own, not hard to do. All you need to do to accomplish that is to read the first book of the Torah. And everything that Yahweh asked of Abraham, that Abraham did, you will find that there are five things that are asked of Abraham that ultimately led to Yahweh offering five benefits to Abraham. The five things that were asked of him are asked of all of us, because there's only one covenant. Its terms and conditions are only presented vis-a-vis the covenant being established with Abraham. These are the terms and conditions. Walk away from your country and your family, by the way. And it says that the country that he was asked to walk away from was Babylon. Babel means confusion and corruption. It's identical with the concept of Awon that was used in this statement that God etched in stone. And God goes on in many of his prophetic books to describe what it is about Babylon and Babel that he dislikes. And he states that his dissatisfaction with Babel and Babylon is religion and politics, with economic and military schemes, the very things we focus on in the first hour of the program. So God asks us to walk away from religion and politics. If you're unwilling to do that, if you're going to cling to your religion, if you're going to be political, if you're going to be patriotic, if you're going to support your military, then understand that's a choice that you have the opportunity under free will to make, but the consequence of that choice is you are automatically excluded from heaven. Now, the second requirement to participate in the covenant is to trust and rely upon Yahweh. Now, you can't trust and rely on someone you do not know. You can't trust someone you do not know. You can't rely on something you do not understand. So for us to be able to trust and rely on Yahweh, we must first come to know him, and then we must understand what he is offering. The only place that you can come to know him and understand what he is offering is to read the Torah. That is where God introduces himself. That's where he explains what he is offering. The third requirement is to walk to God and become perfect. I've said this so many times, but it bears repeating. There's only one path that Yahweh has provided that enables us to walk to him and become perfect. That is the path that leads through the seven Moed Mikrei, these invitations to meet with God. It is what Yahusha fulfilled, the first four of which have already been fulfilled in our past, which paved the way for us to become Yahweh's children, to become immortal, to become perfect, to become enriched and empowered, and to live forever with him. That's the path. That's how we accomplish this. The fourth requirement of the covenant is reiterated here, which is to observe the terms and conditions of the covenant. Pay attention to the covenant. Now, in the instructions to Abraham, rather than using mitzvah, which explains the terms and conditions that are associated with the relationship, and the instructions to Abraham, he asks them simply to shamar bereth, which means to observe the covenant, to closely examine and carefully consider everything associated with the covenant. That's the fourth requirement. The fifth is that as parents, we are asked to circumcise our sons so that they grow up remembering the covenant, and that we raise them remembering the covenant, so that we constantly are reminded and they are reminded of the importance of the covenant. Those are the five terms and conditions. Now, Yahweh is telling us specifically that there are thousands of people who will do these two things: walk to God in love and will observe the terms and conditions of his relationship. Thousands. So when we look at Aleph, which is a cardinal number, by itself it means 1,000. Alephim would mean thousands. It is an actual mathematical representation designating 1,000, and in the plural, thousands. Emphasizing this point, 500 of the 505 times Aleph appears in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, it is translated thousand. God was giving us a very specific quantity of those who would do as he was instructing. We'll return to Shattering Myths in a moment. Hello and welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yetta. We're considering the quantity of those individuals that will avail themselves of Yahweh's offer, who will walk to him in love along the path that he has provided, and who will engage with him based upon what they discover, Yahweh presenting as the terms and conditions of his covenant. And they will do so through observation, which means through focusing upon his Torah testimony, so that they come to know and understand what it is that God is asking of us if we wish to be part of his family. Aleph, in this case, where, as I've shared in the last segment, 500 of the 505 times Aleph appears in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, it is translated thousand. It was written here as Alephim, thereby denoting thousands. And while billions and millions are comprised of thousands, Hebrew is fully capable of expressing the concepts of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and even millions and billions. But God did not communicate to those numbers here. So perhaps no fewer than 2,000, nor much more than 20,000 souls will be reconciled and thus saved. of the tens of billions of souls that have been born on this planet, that is less than one in a million. All of the rest have either been AWOL, corrupted by their parents' babble, or of their own accord, they have chosen to ignore or to oppose God. As we consider what we must do to get on our Heavenly Father's short list, let's examine the verbs which explain how this is done. First, we have Ahab, which describes the covenant. Ahab in Hebrew is a close, personal, affectionate, and loving relationship which is both friendly and familial. God chose to write it in the call participle form, something that must not only be genuine and interpreted literally, but also has a verbal adjective influence, and therefore it influences the nature of the accompanying nouns, which in this case are both God and the thousands who reciprocate his love. Now, most translators ignore the fact that Amar, love, was prefixed with the preposition law. In its simplest form, the preposition law means to. It denotes a movement toward a goal, which in this case describes approaching Yahweh in love. Law speaks about being concerned about someone and of being in accord with them. But more than anything, the primary connotation of law is to move towards a goal, to approach something or someone. To my mind, the inclusion of the preposition law toward in reference to God, especially in the context of receiving his chesed, unmerited favor, explains God's third requirement for participating in his covenant. And as I just shared with you, Yah asks us to walk to him and become perfect, which is to be considered righteous or innocent. Therefore, three of the five things God asked us to accept if we want to develop a relationship with him have been scribed by his own hand. And so we should not be surprised if the fourth requirement is emblazoned in La Shamar Mitzvah, to approach me by closely observing, carefully examining, and thoughtfully considering the terms of my relationship agreement. Since the mitzvah serve as the conditions of the covenant, to shamar mitzvah is to shamar bereth, which is the specific thing that Yahweh asked of Abraham. Once again, Yahweh has used law as a prepositional prefix, which when used in conjunction with shamar mitzvah, tells us that his mercy is for those who approach him by observing and considering the terms of his covenant. Further, written also in the call stem, which speaks not only of relationships, but also of literal and actual interpretations of words, so that we consider the statement in the literal sense as something that is actually true, not hypothetical, is what the call stem conveys. So, this is not symbolism by Yahweh. He's saying, no, I genuinely and actually want you to approach me by observing and considering the terms of my covenant. That's what I want. That's what I'm suggesting. That's my instruction to you. That's my guidance to you. That's my advice to you. So, as I said in the beginning of this segment, there is only one place where you can find the terms and conditions of the covenant. There's only one place where the mitzvah and the covenant instructions reside. The only place where God actually tells us what he expects of us if we wish to participate in the covenant is in the first book of the Torah, Bereshith. So, if you reject the Torah, you are rejecting its covenant. If you reject the Torah, you put yourself in a position where it becomes impossible for you to be amongst the thousands who approach God in love and who observe the terms and conditions of his covenant relationship. That is the consequence of rejecting the Torah. So when Paul speaks negatively of the Torah and it being annulled, when he demeans it, and Christians think that the gospel of grace has replaced the law, au contraire. First, there is no law, there is guidance. And the moment you ignore it, you make it impossible to be saved. You make it impossible to engage in a relationship with God. So, the fact is, if you want to go to heaven, you need to observe the Torah. That's what Shamar Mitzvah tells us. Yah's mercy is for those who approach him by observing and considering the terms of his relationship. And it's this mitzvah, the terms and conditions of the covenant, and this covenant, always singular. There's only one covenant. And it has not yet been renewed, which means there is no New Testament. It will be renewed one day, but that day has not yet occurred. So used here also as a verbal adjective in the construct form, we learn that God's terms not only influence those who are observant, but also that these conditions are absolute and our consideration of them should never cease. God has reiterated in these statements that he has etched in stone, and we're only through the first two of them, but he has conveyed four of the covenant's five requirements. And while they have been presented in no uncertain terms, it is possible to derive the fifth condition from this inception, even though God presented it in the inverse, thereby revealing the consequence of not raising our children within the friendly confines of the covenant. If you recall, God's final instruction regarding forming a loving family-oriented relationship with him instructed us to circumcise our sons. That is the fifth and final prerequisite, if you will, or requirement of participating in the covenant. A uncircumcised male is excluded from God's home. They're excluded from the benefits of Passover. So, circumcision is the sign, according to Yahweh, of his covenant. So our willingness to share its benefits with our children so that they remember what God has promised is essential. Now, I can think of nothing which is more effective in keeping fathers from corrupting their children than this. So when fathers don't circumcise their sons, when their fathers don't focus on circumcision as the sign of the covenant, then they are, in fact, perverting their own children. They are corrupting their own children, as opposed to nurturing them in the truth. So now that we know that Yahweh is our Savior, that he himself is the one who ransomed us by his own testimony, which is what Yahusha means anyway, and we have seen that the covenant's conditions have been reaffirmed through these statements that Yahweh has etched in stone, let's turn to the third and final introductory statement, the third and final statement written on the first of these two tablets. Yahweh engraved the following on the second of these tablets. And I'm going to share with you what he wrote, and then we're going to consider what the words themselves can convey. You should never deceive or delude through the name or reputation of Yahweh your God, advancing worthless and lifeless deception. For indeed, Yahweh will never forgive or leave unpunished those who consistently deceive, actually beguile, or habitually delude people in association with his name, to promote and effect vain and ineffectual lies which lead to lifelessness and destruction. Shemoth 27. So let's look at the words which comprise this, because there is an interesting potential sleight of hand that has influenced what follows. So as we approach these words, it's important that we deal with what I consider to be an interesting challenge, one that has been compounded by the fact that the actual contents of the tablets Yah wrote are not extant among the Dead Sea Scrolls. And that means that we are dependent upon the Masoretes, and their text as it was written, placing diacritical markings on the Babylonian Hebrew characters. This then becomes an issue for us because at present we have no way of telling whether Yahweh intended to convey Nasa or Nasha, words which would have been written identically in ancient Hebrew. The Paleo-Hebrew letter and the Babylonian Hebrew text convey the letter, the S and the SH, identically. But now they are differentiated in the Masoretic by putting a diacritical mark either on the right or left side of a letter, the Shin and the Sin in Babylonian Hebrew, and in modern Hebrew, now after the Masoretes, by putting this letter that looks like a W, in it looks like the English letter W, but it's the Hebrew word either S or SH. SH if the diacritical mark is put on the right upright of the letter, and it is just a plain S if it's put on the left side. Now, normally, doesn't make much of a difference, the S or the SH sound. But because it was written identically in Paleo-Hebrew, we need to consider words which are derived from both of these two possibilities. And we're going to do that when Shattering Myths continues after the break. Welcome back to the final segment of Shattering Myths for today. We're considering an interesting group of possibilities that have emerged, primarily because of the Masoretic influence over the Hebrew text of the portions of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms that aren't extant among the Dead Sea Scrolls. You see, in the original language that Yahweh used to etch these instructions in stone, the Shemek and the Shin were separate letters, and yet the Masoretes decided to make two letters out of the Shin, making one a standard S sound that is equivalent to the Shemek today, and the other being an SH sound by a diacritical mark over the left or right upright of a letter that looks very similar to an English W. Now, the reason that that's important is because if we go back to the original language this was scribed, then it could have been either Nasa or Nasha. Either one of the two words would be a viable alternative for the definition that God was trying to convey here. And this is a very serious undertaking, because God says that doing this is unforgivable. So it's an unforgivable sin to engage in this, so it behooves us to consider all of the possibilities. So, for reasons only known to the Masoretes, which were rabbis, they invented a second means to convey the Shemek or S sound, dividing the Shin into two letters. And therefore, there was originally no distinction between Nasa and Nasha, one now exists. The reason for the concern is because by dotting the Shin one way or the other, two words with different meanings have been arbitrarily made out of one by religious clerics. Now, although these are two words with different meanings, it just so happens that both meanings actually work in this context, although one is vastly more reasonable in the context of an unforgivable sin. Therefore, there is also an interesting paradigm regarding the vocalization of this Nasa or Nasha along with Sho, which is typically rendered Shav now, turning the W into a V sound, and Shav actually becomes the very basis of the Masoretic system, which is to corrupt the sounds made by the Hebrew letters so that the letters that comprise Yahweh's name specifically become pronounced in a different way. So we have a lot of malfeasance in this particular statement, religious malfeasance. Therefore, without actually looking at the tablets or reading the original autograph of the Torah, determining whether God meant to say lo nasa or lo nasha, you should never lift up or bear lo nasa. So don't ever accommodate, accept, lift up, bear, or promote would be lo nasa. Or lo nasha, you should never deceive or delude. So that's the difference between the two. Nasa means don't lift up or bear, don't accept or promote, don't tolerate, where lo nasha would mean don't deceive or delude. It requires considerable diligence on our part. That isn't to say that we can't use the text and the context of Yahweh's testimony to guide us, especially since the conquests, the consequences of whether we lift up and bear that which is show, or we deceive and delude in association with show or showah, depending on the way you wish to pronounce the Hebrew word, the consequence is unforgivable. It's an unforgivable sin. So it is important for us to focus on this and learn as much as we possibly can and use the context of Yah's testimony to guide us as we seek to understand. So the question becomes, did God say that he will not forgive anyone who commits the offense of lifting up and promoting that which is lifeless and deceptive? Or did God say that he would not forgive those who deceive and delude regarding that which is lifeless and deceptive? And the reason this is so important is that if God is saying that if you, lo nasa, if you tolerate, promote, accept, embrace that which is lifeless and deceptive, I'm not going to forgive you. That's a much broader indictment than those if he is saying, if you delude, if you deceive based on using that which is lifeless and deceptive, now you're looking at the perpetrators of religion as opposed to its victims. We'll continue this tomorrow as Shattering This returns at this time.